Thanks for joining us for another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about heirloom seeds with our guest, Jer Gettle. He is the founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds, and they're working like crazy to get seeds out to folks right now. We'll talk with him about the growth in gardening, the popularity of heirlooms, and, of course, take your questions. So what do you like about heirloom varieties? Is there a seed you'd like to find? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Jer Gettle, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Appreciate being here this morning on this beautiful sunny day here in Missouri.
Well, I tell you what, you know, the last time you were on, it was right before the world shut down. How did that affect Baker Creek heirloom seeds?
Well, the last year has definitely been crazy. We've went all over the place as far as our sales go, but in December was our prior biggest month yet. December, some of the days were up to almost five times our normal volume, but it's been just super overwhelming ever since last March, from March till now. And it's finally going back to more normal numbers, finally. But we had a crazy, crazy last 12 months, that's for sure.
Do you have any plans to open up to having guests come by anytime soon?
Sometime this spring or summer. We don't have a date yet, but we're definitely planning and also thinking about, you know, festivals again in the future. You know, for sure next year we're planning, we're starting to plan for next year, if not potentially one this fall. But we're hoping to have the seed store open and our village open in some form, hopefully this summer sometime.
Yeah. I know you collect seeds from all over the world. I wonder, did the pandemic have any influence on that or change it?
It definitely slowed down travel, that's for sure. You know, we're always getting things people send to us, people around the planet, and people that, you know, have things in their home gardens here in the U.S. too. So there's lots of stuff still coming in, and we have a big backlog of stuff we needed to grow that we haven't even tried yet from the years past. So we had plenty to grow, but it definitely slowed down any kind of travels, that's for sure. So
yeah. And I believe you have a big facility under construction. Tell us why you're expanding now.
Well, yeah, the last year, the growth for Baker Creek, the last couple of years, actually, has just kept growing and growing and growing. Normally about, 25% a year for the last few years. But then the pandemic set in, and the election, which is elections are always big years for seed sales, especially around the elections. Any kind of possible instability, anytime people are questioning the economy or anything like that, people put in more gardens. So our growth really spiked this year. So we decided we just needed more space. We were already out of space before the pandemic, and the pandemic basically, we have seeds stored right now, just in every little place we can possibly fit them. And we're having to order supplies a little bit at a time. So we're putting in a 100,000 square foot warehouse over in Seymour, Missouri, which is right about 10 miles down the road from us here. So
do you think the gardening, this trend, this big increase, you think it's going to continue?
It's a good question. I think for the next couple of years, we'll see a lot of new gardeners continuing to come on board. It seems like a lot of people are getting back into gardening. Probably, anytime since probably since the Great Depression this year, so many people got back into gardening. There's been other times when people did it. 2008, 2009 was when we were having the recession. That was a big, big increase in gardeners. But this is for sure the biggest one we've seen in the 20 some years we've been selling seeds. There's been nothing like this. I mean, it's totally, totally so many new gardeners and not just new gardeners, but older, longtime gardeners that are also, putting in bigger gardens as well. So,
yeah, that's great. Heirlooms. Why are heirlooms so important? I think that's a good question to answer.
First off, there's so many different reasons, but first off, they tell the stories and histories of the places they come from. Like a carrot from Kyoto, Japan, tells the history and keeps the food culture of that culture alive, and that history of that town and the communities and the local families. One from Iowa or Wisconsin keeps the varieties, like Pride of Wisconsin, cantaloupe keeps, a piece of Wisconsin's food history alive. Missouri Wonder Bean keeps a piece of Missouri's food history alive. But beyond just the history, they also come in a lot more flavors and colors and shapes and sizes, because they were all developed by different people in different places and different cultures, instead of just by a couple universities or a couple large seed companies in California. You actually have people that were developing them for pickling, or people developing them for just their ornamental value or beauty or flavor or storage or so many different reasons. So you have this big diversity of colors, shapes, sizes. And with all that, is of course, the biggest benefit for humans is the nutritional value. You know, it comes with all that diversity and color.
And why are those vegetables so much more nutritious?
Well, each color, you know, basically, you know, a lot of the store-bought vegetables today come in like one color generally, you know, it's pretty much, and that doesn't necessarily mean that color is bad. It just means you're only getting a small spectrum of what's out there, you know, nutritionally. For example, we've done tests on tomatoes and tests on greens and so forth. Some of the different greens, especially the more colorful ones or the more colorful carrots, for example, will have, you know, in some cases like 10 times as much vitamin A or 10 times as much vitamin C as a standard carrot will. Sometimes it's more intense orange ones. It might be the deep purple ones. And plus, they have anthocyanins and, you know, so many different other, each color group is important. And a lot of colors like the deep purple vegetables just aren't accessible to a lot of people in our diets in the United States anyway. So that's the biggest benefit, is all the different types of nutrition you can get, and also the flavors. Each one tends to have its, you know, orange vegetables and orange watermelons tend to have a little bit of a citrusy taste or a taste from that color group. And the same with purple vegetables. They have that little bit of a plum skin taste, or that, you know, distinct taste that comes with purple fruits and vegetables.
You know, you mentioned carrots, and there's an interesting story about the Griff carrot and how it was saved from extinction. Do you know that story?
A little bit about it. Yeah, it's one that came from Switzerland originally, and it's a beautiful, beautiful old carrot with lavender violet skin, and it in the center ranges from yellow to white right in the middle. But it's a traditional variety from Switzerland that was rediscovered in the 1950s. And it was an older variety that was documented, you know, back some, you know, over 100 years before that, and it had disappeared and was found by local village women in Switzerland who used it for mostly for pickling. So they would use it pickled in olive oil. But it's a delicious, sweet little carrot that, again, you know, so many stories like that where varieties disappeared and were rediscovered. Throughout Europe and the U.S. and around the planet, you know, Japan, there's so many varieties like this that are being saved by just a handful of, a lot of times, older gardeners or small communities, you know, like one little village or, you know, one little area of the United States or Thailand or wherever it might be, is keeping these older varieties alive. And it keeps the stories and their grandmother's stories and their recipes all alive with it. So that's, you know, the fun part of it.
Jerry Gettle, our guest from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. You can join in with your questions. We have some callers online, but there's a line open for you at 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Heather in Madison, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Love your show. Thanks for having me on. My husband and I discovered heirlooms about 10 or 15 years ago when Seed Savers opened a shop on Monroe Street in Madison, and we've been just lovers ever since because we love the diversity. I'm a geneticist by training, so I'm not a plant geneticist, but I do love plants and gardening, and grew up with that as a kid. And one of the ones that this particular pepper that we really love, it's called lemon drop pepper, and it's been really difficult to find. It's about the size of a woman's index finger, and it has a hotter flavor to it, but it has this lemony zest to it, and I've had really difficult time finding it. So if you guys know where I could get those seeds, that'd be great. One of our other recommendations is we got this tomato plant, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but it was originally grown in Siberia, Russia, so it grows great in our climate. It makes a 1 to 2 pound fruit, like a heavy beefsteak tomato. That thing keeps growing almost into and after the first frost. So love heirlooms. They're just so many that have been adapted to our niches and different environments, and like your guest was saying, all the different colors and everything. So highly recommended if people haven't tried them, just looking through the catalog, for me is a joy. So,
well, Heather, thank you so much for calling. Well, a couple of questions there, sort of. Lemon drop peppers. Are you familiar with that one?
I am. That's a good little pepper. We actually carry that in our catalog and on our website. But it's a great little pepper. It's a nice medium to hot, you know, medium to extra hot. It kind of depending. It's way milder than, you know, the super hot peppers, but it's a lot hotter than a jalapeno. But just a really flavorful little pepper with a hint of citrusy, fruity taste to it. So it makes a great salsa or for anybody that likes medium to, you know, hot.
So how does she get a hold of your catalog, or how does she?
Right now it's best. I mean, you could just Google it, the lemon drop pepper. You can Google that and find it on our website or go to our website at rareseeds.com. But you can, and there's several sources online for lemon drop right now. I don't know who has it in stock though. And I'm not for sure if we have it in stock either, because after this year, everybody, but probably a quick Google search. I don't know who all has it, but I'm sure there's a couple people hopefully that still have it available right now.
All right, there we go. And any comment? So we've got a tomato variety that came out of Siberia, I believe. Any guesses as to what that one might be?
Not a clue, because there's so many tomatoes out of Russia and, parts of the former Soviet Union. But the nice thing is I have found with a lot of the varieties from the Soviet Union, a lot of them do very well up north. And they also do well oftentimes in areas with surprisingly warm and wet summers as well, because a lot of times they will have a wet summer in a lot of parts of the former Soviet Union. Depending on where you're at, some parts are very dry as well. So finding varieties from similar climates to where you live. If you're in a northern climate, finding varieties that tend to be from northern climates. If you're in, but again, Wisconsin can get hot in the summer. So finding varieties that are from a northern climate, but maybe also gets warm in the summer. You know, if you get a coastal variety where it stays 70 all the time, they don't tend to do as well as varieties that are, you know, look for varieties from climates similar to yours around the planet, and oftentimes those will do the best.
Heather, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Kel in Sugar Camp. Hi, Kel.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm looking for some varieties of petunias. I think I found a source in the Philippines for the fluffy ruffles and the giants of California, but I'm looking for the Cascade series, the Royal Cascade, which is the deep purple, and the White Cascade. Just a couple of hanging baskets of those in my yard in the 70s would perfume the whole yard, and I would have all these hummingbird moths and bees, and the Cascade series was wonderful.
Huh. Jer, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know on that one. I've heard of the Cascade series, but I don't know where and who is still producing them, if they're still being produced or not. I don't have a clue on that one. But a lot of the older petunia varieties are a lot more fragrant, though, than the more modern varieties. If you're looking for fragrant ones, you know, you can go with, like, wild petunia varieties and also some of the old-fashioned. There's, like, old-fashioned mixes. Several, they go by different names, but different old-fashioned or historic petunia mixes that are available from like Seed Savers or us or a bunch of different companies carry an old fashioned mix, and those will be really fragrant, but they probably won't be as uniform as like the Cascade mix or Cascade varieties were, but they will be more like a wild petunia, which is really fragrant, long lasting, but not as necessarily big uniform flowers.
Thank you, Kel, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Talking with Jer Gettle, zeroing in on heirloom seeds. And we can take your gardening questions as other questions that you might have relating to gardening, too, I think. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company and its catalog, Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Catalog. It's fun to talk with our guest today about it, Jer Gettle. Been growing things for a long, long time and has a lot of experience. I hope you'll join in with your questions at 800 642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Lynn in Oshkosh emailed that last time you were on, she ordered some heirloom seeds from Baker Creek. The tomatoes are doing great, but the green twister coneflowers are not doing well. She planted 8 little pots about 4 weeks ago, but only 3 seedlings have come up, and they're still pretty tiny. Is it too late for the others? What can she do to encourage the ones that haven't sprouted?
Yeah, that's a good question. Echinacea and coneflower and echinacea is a wildflower, so they can be a little erratic with germination, and sometimes they can just be a little touchy with germination. But once they get going, they tend to be really hardy once you get them in the ground. Starting is always the most difficult process with them. If you don't have good results, just let us know, then we'll get you some more seeds. The other option you can do is start them directly in the ground, you know, probably in another few weeks. Or actually, you could put them out right away in the ground because they will actually take cold weather. So put them in the ground when you get the seeds. Let us know if they don't do well, and we'll get you some more seeds. You know, some people struggle indoors with starting the seeds. Some people, they are just as easy as can be, and other people struggle with the indoor starting of them. So they can just be a little touchy to get going at first.
Okay, good luck, Lynn. Thank you. Mark in Richland Center, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Can you give us some pointers on how to save seeds? For example, how far apart do you have to plant certain varieties to be separated from other varieties of the same species so that you have seed that will be true?
Okay.
That's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question. It all depends on the crop. Some crops are self-pollinated and hardly will cross at all. Other crops are wind-pollinated primarily, and other crops are primarily insect-pollinated. So wind is the farthest. It can go anywhere from a half mile to a couple miles or more, you know, like corn. Corn is one of those, an easy example. Self-pollinated crops include things like green beans and tomatoes, and those are the easiest. Most home gardeners can get by with, like, you know, even as little as 10 or 15 feet, you know, for just home garden seed saving. And then you have the crops that are pollinated by insects, and those, you know, need about a half a mile, like melons and cucumbers. If you're growing two varieties of cucumbers together, you need to isolate them by either time, which that means, you know, grow a crop early and grow a crop late, or, you know, cover them and hand pollinate, which is, you know, that's more work. So most gardeners either just plant one variety, or if they plant multiple varieties, you know, if they do save seed, you're just taking a chance on what you get. So starting with self-pollinating crops is the easiest, like tomatoes and beans and peas. Those are some easy examples.
Okay. Thank you, Mark, for calling. Mary in Wauwatosa, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have been trying for 25 years to grow a decent-tasting tomato. And I have tried all sorts of varieties, and they all taste like tomatoes from the grocery store in the middle of winter. Do you have any suggestions?
That is interesting. That's something that I'm fortunately for me, I haven't had that trouble. What do you think, Jer?
Yeah, that's a hard question. It could be to do with soil, or, you know, I don't know if it's soil or climate, or, you know, there's so many variables that can happen. And it also depends on what you like. Do you like, you know, if you like a more acid tomato or a sweeter tomato? But in general, I don't know. I would guess it's probably something to do with the soil or conditions where you're growing. But that would just be a guess because, you know, normally, home garden tomatoes usually taste a lot better, even if they're just a standard, you know, hybrid variety. They usually are going to have a lot more flavor in general than one that's picked. But I would guess it's something environmental, but I wouldn't know what. But
yeah, that's interesting. Maybe try them in pots in a different. You'll have a different kind of soil that way than what you're. At least try one in a pot and see how it goes.
Also, if you're having struggles with bigger tomatoes, oftentimes, you know, if the climate's struggling with bigger tomatoes or your soil, oftentimes smaller cherry tomatoes tend to do better in conditions that might be, more difficult for tomatoes. So oftentimes, especially like in pots, cherry tomatoes, and also just, in any conditions where you're getting a lot of rain, if you get a lot of rain, that can make the tomatoes taste bland. But cherry tomatoes tend to do better in those conditions than the larger, like beefsteak and large tomatoes.
Yeah. Cherry tomatoes, you've got one of the favorite new varieties that you have is a cherry tomato, sweetheart cherry tomato?
Yeah, we love that little variety, especially for winter production here in our greenhouse. But it does equally well outside in the summer. But in the greenhouse, it's our best fruiting tomato. So we start them in August and then have tomatoes till about February, and it gets too cold here where we're at, and they start dying off. But anyway, they've been a huge producer. We were getting about 200 pounds a week this last winter, throughout the winter on them. So that was on about 200 plants though, so that was 1 pound per plant each week. So,
oh man, Joyce, thanks, Mary. Joyce in Muskego will turn to you now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I'm so glad you're on. I'm looking for two kinds of seeds. First of all, the more modern one is Scarlet Runner, and nobody seems to be carrying that. And I'm wondering if it's just out of production or what. And then I'm looking for huckleberries. And I grew them back in the 70s, had a bottle of wine last week that I made, and it was out of this world. So now I got to grow some more.
Okay. Scarlet Runner.
Is that Scarlet Runner bean, maybe? Would it be Scarlet Runner bean, possibly? That's the only thing I can think of that would be.
Yes,
Joyce,
that's it.
Is it a bean? Yeah, it's a bean.
Yeah, and they're actually on the Scarlet Runners. There's multiple different varieties of those, but you can get them through multiple sources. I know Seed Savers Exchange and us both have them. We have several different colors, and we have one called Black Coat, which is a Scarlet Runner with a black seed instead of a multicolored seed. That's been a popular one. And then we also have a sunset colored one, and then we have the traditional red flowered one as well. So,
yeah. So you've got them available in your catalog.
We do, yeah.
Huckleberries?
I don't know if that would be similar to are you looking for the garden huckleberry or a true, like, blueberry-type huckleberry?
Well, it's been so long since the 70s that I had it, but I grew them in the garden.
If it's garden huckleberries and you plant them like tomatoes, basically, early in the season, plant them out in the garden, and then you get a crop the first year, those we have available too. We don't carry like the true huckleberries that grow in the forest, but the garden huckleberries, we carry those, and they're good sweetened. They're tart, though, if they're not sweetened. You'll usually sweeten them.
All right. There you go. And people are wondering again about getting a hold of the catalog or going online to remind us again how to do that.
It's a rareseeds.com. We're currently out of catalogs. We ran out in December this year, but people can request a new catalog for this fall. It will be coming out in November. So if somebody wants to get on the list, we just ran out way early. We ran out about the time they got off the press. So.
Is there an online version that people can see?
They can browse the website, and I believe there is a downloadable catalog there, too, if you want to download it. So people can download a PDF. So.
Okay, there we go. Joyce, thank you for calling. Diane in Frederick, we'll go to you now. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Liz. I have a question. My husband plants a lot of tomato plants every year, and they start out just beautiful, but by late... they have a blight that goes up and takes all of the foliage off. Is it the soil or what?
No. So it's a late blight.
Yeah, we have a lot of issues in Missouri with tomatoes and late blight. And a lot of our problems here is we get way too much water. So it's a big issue. So what we've been doing the last few years is it costs a little money, but investing in like a high tunnel greenhouse, you can get a really small one or a large one, but they're a lot cheaper than a traditional greenhouse. It's basically a layer of plastic over pipes. So you're just trying to shield them from water. And that's made our tomato production go up like four times.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, because it's the water splashing up onto the leaves, I think, that creates the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, water splashing up. And in our case, it's not just blight, but, you know, some years, you know, 1 year will be a normal, and then the next year you will have an 11-inch rain or something like that, and it just destroys the tomato crop. So it gets rid of both the blights and also excessive rain. And the plants just love the filtered light for some reason in the middle of summer when it's so bright. Tomato plants just grow crazy with the filtered light inside the cheapest high tunnel greenhouse you can put up. You don't need a lot. And it will also keep your tomatoes going into the fall away. You know, you might get an extra 30 days of tomatoes in the fall and maybe an extra 30 days of season in the spring to get them started. So it definitely gives us a lot more season. And that's without heat, of course. With heat, you can go as long as you want to pay the propane bill or whatever. But it's definitely something you can even do yourself with some, you know, piping and or buy a kit. It can range from a few hundred to, you know, a few thousand dollars. But you can definitely, you know, build your own if you have the interest or time or ability, or, you know, buy a kit. It is a little bit of money, but it in our case, I mean, it pays for itself oftentimes in a single season with the amount of produce we get out of them. So,
yeah, there you go, Diane. Thank you so much for calling. And tell your husband, if he continues to plant his tomatoes outdoors, don't get them too close together. They need to have room to for the wind and so forth to dry the leaves, and that can help cut back on the problems.
Mulching the soil might help too if they're outside. Mulching the soil and going with small cherry varieties tend to be more resistant as well, especially ones that are like the currants or the ones that have some wild genetics in them. But the smaller tomatoes tend to do better, and also tomatoes from tropical places, like if you get varieties from Southeast Asia, Africa, or Florida, varieties that come from areas with high disease pressure.
Thank you again, Diane. Let's go to Beverly in Bayfield. Beverly, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have my Baker seeds, the floral ones that my daughter-in-law and I have are all out as seedlings. But I ordered Mizuna, and I tried that in the pot, and that didn't sprout. So my question is, can it be planted outside at this point, or should I try it in the pot again?
I would try planting it outside. Oftentimes, we have better success, you know, just out in nature than in pots. But if it doesn't grow, let us know. As far as the growing season for Mizuna, you should be able to plant it basically, as soon as the ground is workable and you're not going to get below probably 25 degrees or, you know, in that range for, you know, basically if you plant it now, as long as it's not going to get, it won't be up till about the middle of April. So I would probably plant it somewhere between now and the middle of April. And then you can keep on planting it almost through the summer, maybe in the middle of summer, like July, you might hold back just a little bit and then restart planting again in August for the fall, like mid-August. So you basically can plant it throughout the spring and summer season, and it's fairly bolt resistant, so it won't go to seed like lettuce will as quickly generally. But I would plant it a few times throughout the summer months, and that way you'll have a continuous supply.
All right. Good luck, Beverly. Thank you very much. Joe in Sauk County, your turn now. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just, to the woman who called in about problems getting good tasty tomatoes, I want to highly suggest soil testing. And it's got to be soil, I think. I had the same problem back in Indiana and ran a soil test, and I was really low in sulfur and calcium. And we got both by using gypsum. I'd say something like that's got to be soil problem. Thanks.
You know, yeah, thank you, Joe. And that's a really good piece of advice. And when you do the soil test, if you can go online to the soil testing lab here in Wisconsin, they tell you how to take the soil test, but then you also tell them what you're growing. And if you say, this is for tomatoes, they will also do some analysis with that in mind. So that's a good thing to do. Thanks, Joe.
Oh, that's great.
Becky in Beloit, your turn. Hi, Becky.
My parents grow a garden, and they have it all cleared out by some pine trees. Now, they haven't had luck with them in the last couple of years, and I wonder if it's because they mulch the plants with the pine needles, and they always keep them real moist. And I wonder if that could be part of the problem for them not bearing a whole lot of fruit, and not good fruit either.
Hmm. Well, it would take a lot of pine needles to affect the soil, but here's another time I think, Jer, where a soil test would be a good thing.
Yeah, soil test would probably be good. And I know we've done wood chips, like acid wood chips, and it has affected us some, so it could be. And if it is keeping the soil really wet, that could also be, that could be part of the problem too. I mean, it could be a combination of both because a lot of plants don't like it super wet. So our biggest challenge in much of the Midwest and East is too much water in the summer. And so that can really lower your yields if the soil isn't draining well.
Yeah. Becky, good luck. Thank you. Get a soil test there and see what you come up with, and then the moisture, something to watch for too. Dorothy in Green Bay, thank you for calling.
Hi. I wanted to let you know I am affiliated with an heirloom plant sale at the University of Green Bay. And every year we get a lot of our seeds from Baker Creek, along with Seed Savers and other places. We plant like 60-some varieties of tomatoes and almost 50 varieties of peppers, which we sell transplants in mid-May as a fundraiser. So just wanted to let you know that.
That's at the UW Green Bay, Dorothy?
It's at UW. Yeah, yes, it is. And this year, actually, we have, because of the pandemic, people will be able to order transplants online and then pick them up.
All right. Thank
That's
you,
really
Dorothy.
Cool. Yeah. I've known about that program for, 15 or 20 years, probably 20 years. Dr. Jeff Nicola, he's not there anymore, but he used to come down from there and speak at our festivals and he helped He helped with that plant program back in the day and getting it established. And a lot of his varieties were part of the project at one time, but he's in Greece now, I believe, teaching. But I love Green Bay, by the way. It's a beautiful area up there.
Thanks, Dorothy. Appreciate it. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I have my vegetable peelings and my eggshells and all that stuff, and I just throw it out in my garden. Well, I heard that you're supposed to wait 5 days till the temperature is over 50 degrees before you do your rototilling. And years ago, I used to be able to get manure. We used to get manure from a dairy farmer here, but no more cows here. So, what's a good fertilizer and some good advice to get some decent getting that garden going decent again? I appreciate your answer.
What do you think, Jer?
Oh, yeah, that's always a difficult one, trying to figure out what to fertilize the garden with. One thing you can do that isn't probably a complete plan, but it will help is planting cover crops in the fall and even in the spring, or overwintering cover crops. Work those in, like some peas or, vetch or different. That will help build the soil and add some nutrition. But as far as finding amendments to apply, what we've been using is, and again, if you it depends on what you can find in your area, but we found some like organic turkey farms and we've brought and chicken farms and brought some manure in from those. We also compost whatever we can, and we always have a compost pile going to add to it. But it kind of depends on what you can find in your area. If you could find a rabbit farm around, that would be great. But it kind of depends. A lot of times it's difficult to find. And if you can't find anything, then there's the other alternative of, buying bagged fertilizer in various forms. I mean, if you're organic, there's lots of options. If you're not, I mean, there's even more. But organic options, there's a lot of, you can find like processed chicken manure products that don't really smell anymore, but you can apply them to your garden. If you have a large garden, it can get expensive, but sometimes that's your only choice. Fish products. There's also vegetable products if you want a vegetable-based product. So there's lots of options out there, like at a large garden center type place. But it's just they're all pricey unless you can find a local farm that just wants to get rid of, like, their rabbit manure or whatever. Besides composting, of course. But
yeah. And Nancy, as Jared was just saying, you can still compost those peelings and so forth right through the winter. I mean, you can put them in your compost, make a compost pile, put it in the pile, and it'll eventually be a good amendment for you. So you can do it all year round. Gary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, I was wanting to know, how do you grow asparagus?
How do we grow asparagus? Jared, do you sell asparagus root?
We sell the seed. What we do is we start it in trays, like flats, any time in the winter, but usually probably about, it doesn't really matter, but, you know, sometime around midwinter, early, you know, to early spring, and get it going in trays. But it doesn't really matter when you start it, anytime in the spring. Then we transplant it into the garden, and sometimes if you're short on space, you can keep it close together for a year until the plants get bigger and then transplant them. Or you can grow them up and put them out just about where you want them to be. But the biggest thing is putting them into an area with kind of sandy soil and then keeping the weeds worked down for the first year or two till it starts producing. It's probably about 2 years before we start harvesting. And, you know, the first season, and then there is, you know, some spears the next season after the first season. But it'll probably be about the second year or so before, about 2 years out before you get a full bed of it. Another option is starting with plants. But either way, you need to make sure you have a kind of a sandy, loamy bed and keeping the weeds down somehow. Mulching and of course, weeding is important. But other than that, it's pretty easy to go. It's pretty much is just watered on its own. We don't really water it much unless it's a really dry spell.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to when I was a young kid. My dad had some asparagus plants that weren't doing anything, and he just dug them out. And my brother Mitch had a sandbox, and he just stuck them in the sandbox, and then they revived and grew well. So you're right about the a little more sand there in the soil to help them go a little better. Jared Gettle, our guest,
salt too, but.
Yeah.
Some people apply salt too, but other, you know, that's all about I know about asparagus.
Jared Gettle, our guest from Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. I'm Larry Mealer. Join in with your questions. The number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mealer here with my guest, Jer Gettle of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. Talking with him about heirloom seeds today and answering your gardening questions as well. As we move along, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Jer, earlier you were talking about nutritional value in vegetables, and a listener emailed to ask, who tests nutrition in the vegetables, and how could she find that information? She thinks people would be appalled at the loss of nutrition through breeding of some fruits and veggies that are commonly sold in grocery stores. Can you talk about any difficulties in getting that info to the public?
We're actually working on it right now. We put some information over the last few years in our catalogs. We're working on working through testing a lot of our fruits and vegetables in the catalog, and we use SGS Laboratories out of South Dakota. That's the at least the branch that we use for testing. But it's expensive, and it's kind of time intensive getting it all done. So we're working on, we're up to about 300 and some vegetables right now. And we could, if somebody emails us, we could try to send them a report, what we have so far. It wouldn't be conclusive yet, but kind of give people an idea. But we're definitely seeing a wide range. A lot of the Asian green leafy vegetables are super high in nutrition. And the dark colored carrots are, you know, really high. But, you know, a lot of surprises out there, like the it's a kale, Lacinato kale, or it goes by dinosaur kale, or Neo di Toscana, or it has a bunch of different names. It's the long, dark, deep green kale that goes palm tree kale. But anyway, we tested it, and it had like almost 5% protein, which is really high in any kind of leafy vegetable, especially considering they're mostly, you know, a good portion of our water. So it's a, you know, if you took the water out of it, it would be very comparable probably to beans or a lot of other high protein seeds and so forth.
Boy, that's great. Heather called back to say that the tomato she was thinking about was called the giant Syrian tomato, and it grows great in Wisconsin, big tomatoes, and it can take over the garden, the giant Syrian tomato.
Well, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it does indeed. Thanks for that, Heather. Deb in Menominee Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am interested in getting some information about how to set up best for a new container. I'm trying to grow a Roma-style tomato. They're called Pastes or San Marzano. And I'm going to buy a different container because the container that I used last year wasn't big enough. So I'm wondering how big a container should I get if I want to plant a few plants, and how much soil base do I need to put in, because the container I'm thinking of is deeper than what needs to be entire soil, but I want to make sure that I give the tomatoes enough soil to thrive in.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Jer?
Well, it kind of depends on, you know, the fertilizer. As far as putting multiple plants in one container, the challenge will be is making sure the container is big enough so they get air circulation and so forth. And the more you put in there, you know, that there could be a slight risk of that. So I would say at least 5 gallons per plant, but, you know, I would probably, if it was around 5 to 10 gallons, I would only put one plant in there. And then you're in containers. The other difficulty is they tend to use up all their nutrients quickly. So you'll need to make sure you fertilize them with something regularly, just to make sure they don't quit producing. And I would plant at least 12 inches of soil, if not more, before you went to gravel or something else underneath it. But, you know, at least 12, 14 inches of soil in there. But it's difficult because it kind of depends on how much you fertilize. I mean, tomatoes, you could probably grow it in a 6-inch pot if it was fertilized enough. But that wouldn't be practical, and keeping it, then you would be risk over fertilizing. So a bigger pot is better if you could go with like 10 gallons for a plant. If you had a really big container, you know, maybe like 30 gallons, you might get by with like 2 or 3 plants.
I remember planting some tomatoes in straw bales, and at the end of the season, looking at the length of the roots had gone all the way through, at least, what is that, 15, 20 inches that it, those roots had gone down. I mean, they'll go a long ways. They'll grow a long way, for sure. Deb, thanks. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Kathy in Crandon emailed to ask if it matters what brand the seeds are. She's been having so much trouble finding pole beans this year. She finally bought the Walmart brand. They are Kentucky Wonder, I think.
To be honest, the Kentucky Wonder, it's such a common variety. The Kentucky Wonder is probably only grown mostly by 2 or 3 different seed growers out there anyway. So it's probably, to be honest, unless it sat a terrible long time on the shelf or was stored in bad conditions, your probably seed is going to be fine whether you buy it at Walmart or Baker Creek or Seed Savers or Burpees or whoever. There's a good chance on some of those common varieties, they're all produced by the same few producers anyway. So it, on unusual varieties, you tend to do better with smaller companies that are really involved with production, though. But on the more common varieties that are on the market, they tend to be produced by just a handful of producers anyway. So, the long answer short is there's probably not much difference where you get it as long as the seed is kept in a, you know, good conditions.
Nancy from Madison planted some Brad's Atomic Grape tomatoes from Baker's last year. She just loved them. And have this year's seeds already planted? She has them planted indoors already. She can't wait for more. And she sent us a photo of those tomatoes. They are really beautiful tomatoes.
I love those. Most people love them, and some people dislike them if they like a tart tomato. They're a super sweet, fruity tomato. So if you like sweet and fruity, you'll love it. If you're thinking of like a tart, sour tomato, that's definitely not one to grow.
Brad's Atomic. All right. Let's see. Misha in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Misha.
Hi there. I'd like to have a fangirl moment and say, Jer, I've been an admirer for 25 years. And thank you for what you do. I have a question about hybrids. I like growing a lot of stuff for pollinators to support loss of habitat, et cetera. And I'm wondering if hybrids are, I've heard that some hybrids are sterile. I can't quite figure out if I plant a hybrid echinacea, for example, a coneflower, are the pollinators still going to come to it the way they would a straight native plant that's never been hybridized?
Thanks so much for the kind words and also for the question. And I know it varies a lot on the hybrids themselves, but in general, yes, that you should still be successful. The only risk would be, I would think, is the ones if they're developed for lower pollen, which I don't know that echinacea is, that's happening to it as much as like sunflowers, but the other risk is the double echinaceas and the really full echinaceas, which are really beautiful. They may be more difficult for the bees to get at the pollen and the pollinators too. So the single big flower heads are best, the big. The other thing with hybrid echinacea, it comes in some amazing colors and shapes, but it also, you know, you're talking, you know, well, anywhere from, you know, a lot of it's like $10, $15 a plant versus, you know, a lot of it's available from seed. And, you know, from various sources and seeds. So you can get it for maybe, you know, you can get 25 plants or 50 plants for the same price, you know, if you start your own seed. And echinacea, you know, you can plant it directly out or start it inside. And it's one that, you know, we grow hundreds of plants every year. And it's, if you start it early, you get a huge amount of flowers clear up till frost. It's definitely, but I would go ahead and try some of the hybrids if you see something you like. But if it's a double, a really full double, you may not get as much pollinators.
Thank you, Misha, for calling. Ron in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Thank you for growing heirloom vegetables and sharing, selling the seeds. Is your current warehouse and processing buildings above the Gasconade River floodplain? And thank you very much for building the new one at Seymour, more than 1,600 feet above sea level. The reason I'm preaching is in the Philippines, they built their national rice seed inventory, isn't the right thing, collection of dozens or hundreds of varieties of rice. After they got it built and stocked with their heirloom seeds, they call it the typhoon in the Western Pacific, flooded the building with the seed. So I'm very glad your new place is high above the floodplain. I grew up in Missouri, southwest part there. You're only a couple hundred miles from the New Madrid seismic zone. So I urge you to put in extra diagonal strength in your building, either 2x6s from the base of one steel girder up to the top of the other, or 2x6 posts if that's what you're using. Another option is diagonal steel rods with threads on the end so you can tighten them up to keep the earthquake from shaking it sideways and knocking it down. Sorry to be picky about it.
No, appreciate the ideas. We are above the floodplain here where we currently are. We'll be even be higher at Seymour, of course, as you just mentioned. But the new building the old buildings are basic warehouse buildings, but the new structure is advanced with lots of extra support. And our biggest threat at Seymour area and this area in general potentially is high winds and tornado activity, which has been, you know, always a struggle to build for. So we went to their most advanced package as far as lots of cross beams, and it's all steel. So, and all, you know, it's all, there's no wood in the building. So that's also a fire, fire prevention, but we're definitely trying to use the advice you just gave us on the new building, because we're wanting to make sure it's keep everything safe and everybody safe, of course. So appreciate the words.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ron, for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, our guest today, Jer Gettle, he's been growing things since he was 3, as I mentioned earlier. He's at 17. He printed the first Baker Creek heirloom seed catalog, and he sent out a million of them already this year. In fact, they're already out. But you can go online to Baker Creek Seeds and find out all you need to know about getting seeds from them. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller, for this edition of Garden Talk. We're visiting about heirloom seeds with our guest, Jer Gettle, founder of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. They offer over 1,200 varieties of vegetables, flowers, and herbs. It's the largest selection of heirloom varieties in the U.S. What varieties of heirlooms do you like to grow or eat? You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go back to the phones. Denise in Washburn, we'll turn to you now. Denise, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for having me. So last year at this time, when Mr. Gettle was here on your radio show, I was disappointed but understood that the cancellation of the Baker Creek Festival was going to be. The reason I was disappointed was because I was surprising a 70-year-old, a friend who was turning 70 years old for his birthday party, because he's an avid gardener. So we were going to take our trip from Wisconsin down to Missouri to tour the grounds and participate in the festival. So what I was looking for today was is hearing a little bit more about the day-to-day activities at the farm, hearing about how the seed processes goes, the growing, a little bit about maybe some of your employees and what sorts of needs you have and people to work there, and just knowing more about the farm itself. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Denise. Jer?
Sure, yeah. We'd love to have you come sometime. We're getting ready to reopen, hopefully sometime this summer. We're having to clean the grounds a bit and do some repairs and other related activities to get back open again. But, yeah, we'd love to have people stop in. Our farm here is in the Missouri Ozarks. We're on about 17 acres here currently, and then we have about another 40 acres now over at Seymour, Missouri, where we're working on building our new buildings. We're going to also keep our buildings here busy as well, and our gardens and greenhouses here on the farm, as well as the new farm, which is 10 miles away. But anyway, day-to-day activities this last year has been just trying to keep up with orders. We've had employees working 24 hours a day for 5 or 6 days a week in shifts, of course, you know, like 8-hour shifts. And hopefully with the new location, we will be able to go back to 1 or 2 shifts again once we get more room and more space. But it's been a crazy year. Besides shipping orders and packing orders, of course, through the spring and summer and even in the winter, we always have people gardening inside in the greenhouses in the winter and outside and inside throughout the summer months. So our normal day here is a mixture of inside activities on shipping orders and packaging and so forth, and then part days outside planting and growing and harvesting. And that's pretty much, you know, what we do, as well as a lot of other, you know, related activities. But it's always a lot of fun and always a lot of new challenges.
And you hope that not this coming summer, but the summer after? Or are you going to try and do some, I've forgotten now what you said about.
We may have a small festival even this autumn, potentially. We'll see where it goes. We're kind of going day by day, and there's so many different things we got to think about, you know, insurance and so forth. We're finally, you know, for the festivals, it's, you know, and also just getting everything set up again. But we're trying to evaluate the risk later on this year as far as events and reopening and all that. But we're definitely getting closer finally. For the last year, we couldn't have had events if we would have wanted to. We were so backlogged with work. You know, we were thankful that we were able to actually kind of partially shut down to keep up.
Okay. Scott in Windsor, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question that specifically is aimed at heirloom tomatoes, but heirloom seeds in general. Heirloom tomatoes or any sort of tomato seeds can be dried and then replanted, but these aren't true breeding, are they? They aren't, unless you're clonally propagating them, they can't be. So I'm just curious as to how, if I harvest and dry seed, how close will it be to the plant that I grew, that they were grown on? How do you yep. perpetuate heirloom seed variety?
Varieties will change slightly over time, but in general, like if you say seed from a Cherokee purple tomato, you will get almost the same thing each year. There will be slight variations occasionally, but very little. Over hundreds of years, sometimes, you know, a variety can morph into something else. But basically, to keep that from happening, gardeners generally select, you know, if you have 100 plants or a seed company and you notice something going in a direction you don't like, you just don't say seed from that direction. But in general, most gardeners won't even hardly notice the difference year to year in a lot of varieties. There are some things like zinnias, for example. Zinnia flowers tend to drift really quickly. So if you say zinnia seeds, you're always selecting every generation for your best ones, so they don't all turn back to a earlier ancestor. But zinnias tend to all want to go back to a wild zinnia from 100 years ago if they're left alone. But so basically on those, we're always selecting them for the best type. You know, every seed company is, you know, not every year, but we tend to always be watching that. But on most crops, you know, you're pretty reliable. You just kind of watch for off types, select out the off types, you know, get rid of any plant that isn't producing what you're expecting. And generally you're good to go as long as you don't have a neighbor that's also if your neighbor's growing melons, you could have cross-pollination. But as long as you have some distance between you and your nearest gardener, you're pretty much able to grow anything you like as long as you use normal precautions.
There you go, Scott. Thank you so much. Jane in Madison, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Jane. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering about composting. I'm composting for my garden soil, and I'm just wondering, does it need to be in the sun to get enough heat for it to work?
You mean in the compost pile itself?
Yeah.
Okay. Jer, what do you think?
I don't really know. I mean, it also depends on how warm your climate is, I guess. But ours is in the sun half the day and in the shade half the day. It gets toasty hot inside there with all the activity going on in, you know, as it breaks down. So ours gets, you know, really hot inside. But again, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't really know. I don't think it would have to be. But of course, the sun would definitely help heat it up a little more even. So it definitely wouldn't hurt. But I don't think you would need it. It would definitely stuff compost right in the woods, you know, in the shade. But with more heat, of course, it'll probably speed the process up a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Thanks, Jane, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Michelle in Manitowoc emailed that she's looking at your website, looking to purchase Cosmos seeds. There does not seem to be information regarding the plant height, when and where to plant, or the amount of sun needed. Where does one find that information?
We don't. On Cosmos, they're a sun-loving crop, first off. So pretty much they need, you know, pretty much a full-day sun. You can get a little bit of shade in the afternoons, okay. But as far as height goes, we haven't listed that because there's so much variation on who plants them and where. We've had some of the varieties grow, you know, in our, depending on our garden here, will grow anywhere from 18 inches. But if they're in soil or they're looking for more, you know, in certain soils or also in areas where they are getting a little bit of shade, they tend to grow taller looking for sun. So, I mean, in some of our gardens, they will get, oh, you know, 36, 40 inches. The same variety in other gardens will be, you know, 20 inches or 24 inches. But we do have a couple dwarf ones in there. If you look on the listing and look for dwarf, and they tend to stay under 24 inches, you know, mostly under 20 inches. But if they're not dwarf, expect anywhere from 24 inches to probably up to 40 or 48 inches even. But in general, you know, the smaller, the dwarf ones will stay small, but if they're not dwarf, expect big plants on them.
Steve in Green Bay called to say he uses aspirin diluted in water to get rid of tomato blight. He sprays the solution on his plants a couple of times a week, and it works great. Someone looked it up. The United States Department of Agriculture found that salicylic acid produced an enhanced immune response to plants of the nightshade family. The enhanced response helped prepare the plant for microbial or insect attack. That's a new one on me. Yeah, that's a new one on me, and I have no idea how much, how many aspirin it takes. Aspirin's relatively inexpensive, that's for sure, but I have to look that one up.
That's a cool one to look into.
Yeah, it is indeed. Larry emailed to ask how you water your tomatoes if you use plastic sheeting to shelter them from rain.
We use drip tape. It's in the ground. We hook it to a timer and just hook up the cheap, inexpensive drip tape. Not drip hose, but drip tape, which is a lot cheaper. It will last. It can last one or two or three seasons if something doesn't chew into it. But it works really well. And inside the greenhouse, it tends to we tend to lose a little less water in there, actually. So, and if you mulch a little bit, you don't have to water that much. I mean, it tends to we water regularly, but not for only a few minutes each day. Is what I think we turn them on for about 5 minutes a day, and just kind of watch it. If it starts getting too damp, we just turn it off or turn it down. Actually, you know, turn it to 3 minutes or 4 minutes, and it's really automatic. So it's no work with watering. It's just once you get it set in, you drop your drip tape and get it hooked up. And we use that actually in the gardens too, which we only use part time whenever we have a dry spell. But it's really once you get it dialed in inside a greenhouse, you don't have rain. So, you know, it comes on every day at a certain time and you just adjust it a little bit with the seasons. But other than that, there's no work involved.
Susan in Wausau, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. My daughter lives for Madison. And I have seen you at the Bayfield Garden Show. And just east of there, I used to live up in the Upper Peninsula, and they have thimbleberries. And I've never seen any plants or seeds or anything, and I was going to ask your guest if they have any in their catalog. They've been around forever up there, so I'm assuming they're very they're very native up there. And I just wonder if you have them and if they can be grown in central Wisconsin. And also, if they're going to have the Bayfield Garden Show this year, Larry, are you going to be going to Garden Talk up there?
I won't be doing Garden Talk up there this year. I'm not sure if it's even going to go on this year, Susan. I'm kind of miss doing that show. It's always a lot of fun. And I think it may be one more year before I might have an opportunity to go back. But thimbleberries, Jer, are you familiar with thimbleberries?
I am. I used to eat thimbleberries when we lived out in Montana as a child. They usually grow in the forest. I know you can order them. We don't carry the plants or seeds, but I know you can order them from a lot of different sources online. There's several sources I'm seeing here with a quick Google search, but it's not one that we carry. I don't know how well they will do outside of like the forest areas where they normally grow. That's one that is not cultivated a real lot. It may need to have kind of a forest I don't know. That would be one to look into, because they generally, I don't know anybody growing them in this area anywhere where we live. And I don't actually, I've never known anybody anywhere growing them outside. I know people do grow them, but I don't know anybody personally. So I don't know the instructions.
There you go, Susan. Thank you. Kurt in Oak Creek, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Yes. We have some friends who live in Leamington, Ontario, and they moved from Oak Creek, South Milwaukee area, and we went to visit them, and we took a bag of fresh tomatoes from our garden, and I handed them to them, and I said, what are you bringing us tomatoes for? We're in the tomato capital of the world. Leamington, Ontario dips down even with Evanston, Illinois, as a geography, that they're 2 weeks ahead of Milwaukee in the growing season. And it's in the middle of Lake Erie. Beautiful. The greenhouses go for miles. But we brought them tomatoes as a nice treat, and all we smelled was processing plants.
Oh, man. That's a good story, Kurt. Thank you so much. He mentions Canada. You know, in your 2021 catalog, there's a story about a Canadian farmer, Percy Schmeiser. Talk about him and what his fight with Monsanto did for farmers and gardeners alike.
Yeah, look, Percy, back in the 90s, I can't remember the year, it was mid or early 90s, had been growing canola for years. And anyway, I got to remember the story, right? But anyway, somehow some pollen or seed got washed in or blown in from a truck going by. And I believe it was seed. And anyway, Monsanto at the time was checking fields randomly, I guess, for, you know, genetic pollen. And his case was that, you know, they trespassed on there, gathered stuff that he didn't plant, that had blown out in there from a truck going by or whatever, and that he didn't want in his crop, and then sued him over his crop growing, because they found some of their patented seeds and pollen in his field. You know, a percentage of them were, you know, and so his case was, he fought in the Canadian Supreme Court for years over it, back and forth. And he was basically the first person to bring to light, I guess, in a big way, you know, in a way that's beyond just it in a lecture or a university or something, but in an actual physical way, bring to light the issues of seed, controlling the seed and patenting and the whole issue of genetic modification and all these different issues, and bringing to light how we would want to, you know, what the future of food and agriculture was going to look like, whether it's, and it's still kind of a question, whether it's going to be controlled by a few corporations with patents, or whether, you know, small farmers are going to be growing their own varieties and saving their own seeds and have control over local countries and the global, you know, on the global sphere, like, you know, does India have their own seeds, or are they dependent on American seeds, or vice versa? You know, it's the whole ability to, he brought to light the whole ability to save your own seed and the question of who owns the seed. And that's basically what he kind of brought to light for a lot of people, especially in the 90s.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, speaking of your catalog, it's 500 pages. It's almost more magazine. It's as much magazine, I think, as it is seed catalog. There are so many interesting stories and so much interesting information in it, and it's so beautiful. When did you decide to make it so beautiful, or is that just...
Oh, just kind of grown and evolved, and we've got some great people here. We've had great photographers. Our current photographer is amazing, and every year we keep growing things, and we're just amazed by the colors and shapes and sizes and stories of everything. So it's, you know, just really fun to work with photos and work with all these beautiful vegetables. Every one is like, you know, so many of them look like art, or, you know, the flowers as well and the herbs. It's just the whole thing, and being in the garden, it's just amazing anytime you can be outside. And we're just trying to bring that all inside for people in the winter in a catalog form, trying to bring all the excitement of the garden into the house. So
it's beautiful. It really is beautiful. And you're sold out for this year, although I think you probably get an online version, a PDF version you could download from your website. But how do folks get on the list for the 2022
Just go to our website and people can sign up for catalogs, and it has more information there. People also, we'll be putting information up like on Facebook and Instagram too as things become available as far as catalogs go. But make sure you request stuff early this year, because that's if it's like last year, they'll probably run out again this year. So request one early, and any seed catalog you might want to, any nursery or seed catalog or hatchery catalog, all the you know, gardening and farming related catalogs. I think this year we're in short supply. It seems like. You know, so any kind of everything from gardening supplies to, you know, animal supplies, honeybees, everybody was busy in this whole, you know, gardening, homesteading, you know, small scale farming. The whole bit of it was just incredibly, so many people canning their own vegetables and stuff again. It's amazing. So
it is indeed. And it's a lot of fun, and it's wonderful to see. And I, you know, at the beginning of the show, I said, I promised you'd be talking about some of your favorite new varieties. And we did talk about the sweetheart cherry tomatoes, but Casper kale is another one that you like.
Casper kale is a fun one. It's a white colored kale. Probably our most popular, well, we have several. One of our top new varieties this year is called African Nunam basil. It's a basil we got from our friend who grows seeds for us actually in Ghana, West Africa. But it's a huge basil plant, and it just makes a beautiful bright green, you know, huge leaves, gigantic leaves on it, great big. It almost looks like a big shrub. But anyway, the unique thing about it is it tastes more like oregano than basil. And so, you know, oregano is fine to grow, but it's kind of slow. It takes a little while to get going. You eventually get a nice big clump of it. But this basil will overnight pretty much go, as long as it's warm outside, it'll grow from, you know, an inch tall to, you know, a 6 foot, 5-6 foot tall plant over the summer. But you just have a massive amounts of oregano tasting basil. So for pestos or pizzas or, you know, spaghetti, anything you use basil on or oregano, this is like the best combination of both.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. There was a sweet watermelon,
sweet glow watermelon. That's a really good one. That's a new one this year, and it was a cross between the orange glow watermelon and the crimson sweet watermelon. And a guy in over in Michigan on the peninsula there has been developing it for a number of years, and I think it has the best qualities of both. It's really sweet, and probably the sweetest, best tasting watermelon we've tried in at least several years as far as new varieties go. But yeah, there's so many new varieties, and every year that's always the fun part, is checking out something new.
Well, it's always fun talking with you too, Jer. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you.
Appreciate it. You have a great spring up there in Wisconsin.
All right, we will, and you have a great year. Jer Gettle of Baker Creek Heirloom Seeds. He's a great guy, an amazing story. And it's fun to be able to talk with him. If I were you, I would get on his website and get myself on the list for the 2022 version of their catalog, because it is indeed an amazing catalog. It's more like a magazine as far as I'm concerned. Well, Monday we'll look at ways the government can affect climate change. And then at 11:45, the weather guys will be back. So that's for Monday. But you know what? There's lots more in store right through the afternoon, so I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and the Ideas Network.